Benedict eased the big honey-coloured Bentley out of the traffic stream that clogged Bermondsey Street and turned into the gates of the warehouse. He parked beside the loading bay and climbed out. As he pulled off his gloves, he glanced along the bank. Mountains of goods were stacked ready for distribution. Cases of Cape wine and spirits, canned fruit in brown cartons, canned fish, 40-gallon drums of fish oil, bundles of raw hide, stiff as boards, and cases of indefinable goods, all of it the produce of southern Africa. VDB agencies had grown out of all recognition in the 10 years since Benedict had launched it. Benedict climbed the steps to the bank, three at a time, and strode down between the towering stacks of goods that reached up into the murk of the high ceiling. He walked with the assurance of a man on his own ground, the skirts of his overcoat swirling about his knees, broad-shouldered and tall. The storemen and porters greeted him deferentially as he passed, and when he entered the main office, there was a stirring and whispering among the ranks of typists as though a wind had blown through a forest. The managing director hurried out of his office to greet Benedict and usher him in. "How are you, Mr. Funderbale? There's tea coming now." And he stood behind Benedict to take his coat. The meeting lasted half an hour, Benedict reading through the weekly sales and cost reports, querying an item here, remarking on a figure with pleasure or displeasure as it deserved. Many people watching him work would have been startled. This was not the indolent playboy that they thought they knew. This was a hard-eyed businessman coldly and unemotionally milking the maximum profit from his enterprise. There would have been others who wondered where Benedict had found the capital to finance a business of this magnitude, especially if they had known that he owned the premises, and that VDB Agencies was by no means his only stake in the world of business. He had not received money from his father. The old man had not believed Benedict capable of successfully negotiating the purchase of a pound of butter. The meeting ended, and Benedict stood up and shrugged on his overcoat, while his managing director went to the grey steel safe in the corner, tumbled the combination, and swung the heavy door open. "The shipment arrived yesterday," he explained, as he reached into the safe and brought out the can, "on the SS Loch Elsinore from Walvis Bay." He handed the can to Benedict, who examined it briefly, smiling a little at the painting of the leaping fish and the lettering pilchards in tomato sauce. "Thank you." He slipped the can into his briefcase, and the managing director walked with him back to the Bentley. Benedict left the Bentley in a garage in Broadwick Street and walked through the jostle of Soho until he reached the grimy brick building behind the square. He pressed the bell opposite the car that read Aaron Cohen, manufacturing jeweller, and when the door opened he climbed the stairs to the top and fourth floor. Again he rang, and after a while an eye peeped at him through the peephole, but the door opened almost immediately. "Hello, Mr. Funderbale, come in, come in," the young doorman welcomed him in and locked the door behind him. "Papa is expecting you," he went on as they both looked up at the eye of the closed-circuit TV camera above the wrought-iron grill that barred the passage. Whoever was viewing the screen was satisfied, for there was an electrical buzz and the grill swung open. The doorman led Benedict down the passage. "You know the way. Papa is in his office." Benedict was in a shabby little reception room, with a threadbare carpet and a pair of chairs that looked like Ministry of Works rejects. He turned to the right-hand door and went through it into a long room that clearly occupied most of the top floor of the building. Along one side of the room ran a narrow bench, to which were bolted 20 small lathes. Each machine ran off a belt from a central drive below the bench. The man tending the machines wore a white dust jacket, and he grinned at Benedict. "Hello, Mr. Funderbale. Papa is expecting you." But Benedict delayed a moment to watch the operation of the saws. In the jaws of each lathe was set a diamond, and spinning against the diamond was a circular blade of phosphor bronze. As Benedict watched, the man turned back to the task of spreading a fine paste of olive oil and diamond dust onto the cutting edge of each blade. For it was not the bronze that cut. Only a diamond will cut a diamond. "Some nice stones, Larry," Benedict remarked, and Larry Cohen nodded. "All of them between 4 and 5 carats. Benedict leaned close and examined one of the diamonds. The line of the cut was marked with Indian ink on the stone. Benedict knew what heart-searching and discussion, what examination and drawing upon the rich storehouses of experience had preceded the positioning of that ink line. It might take 2 days to saw through each diamond, so Benedict left the bench and moved on. In a row down the other side of the room sat the other Cohen brothers, 8 of them. Old Aaron was a great breeder of boys. They ranged in age from nearly 40 to 19 years, and they were a couple who were still in school and hadn't yet come into the business. "How do you like this one, Mr. Van der Bael?" Michael Cohen looked up as Benedict approached. Michael was shaping a fine diamond, cutting it into a round, using a lesser stone as a blade. A small tray beneath the lathe caught the dust from the 2 stones. This dust would be used later for sawing and polishing. "A beauty," said Benedict. These men were of the Brotherhood, working with diamonds all their lives and loving them as other men loved women or horses and fine paintings. He moved on down the room, greeting each of the brothers, stopping to watch for a minute the loving care with which the elder boys, master craftsmen, each of them, were cutting the precisely angled facets that make up the perfect round brilliant. The 58 facets, table, stars, pavilions, and the others which endow a cut stone with its mystic life and fire. Leaving them crouched over their wheels, so similar to those of a potter, he went through the door at the end of the room. "Benedict, my friend," Aaron Cohen came from the desk to embrace him. He was a tall, thin man in his late 60s, with a thick silver-grey mane of hair, round-shouldered from years of crouching over a diamond wheel. "I didn't know you were in London. They told me you were in Cape Town. Yesterday was Ruby's birthday, if we had known." Benedict took the envelope from his pocket and shook 27 diamonds onto the blotter of the desk. "What do you think of those, Papa?" "Oh, shoo, shoo." Oh. Papa patted his own cheeks with delight, and he reached instinctively for the biggest stone. "Ah, oh, I should live to see such a stone." He screwed a jeweller's loop into his eye, turning to catch the natural light from the high windows, and scrutinised the diamond through the eyepiece. "Ah, yes, there is a feather." A feather is a semi-transparent vein-like flaw. "But it's small. VVSI. Very, very slight imperfection. But we will cut through it. Yes, we will take 2 gems from the stone, 2 perfect diamonds of 10 or 12 carats each, and perhaps 5 smaller ones. More than half a diamond's bulk is lost in the cutting." "Yes, yes, from this stone we will sell £100,000 worth of polished diamonds." Aaron crossed to the door. "My boys, come and see. I'll show you a prince among diamonds." And his sons crowded into the office. Michael took it first and gave his opinion. "A good stone, yeah. But not of the same water as the stone we had in the last batch. You remember that octahedron crystal?"
"What are you talking?" his father interrupted. "You wouldn't know a diamond from a piece of gorgonzola cheese already."
"He's right, Papa," Larry joined in the discussion. "The other stone was better."
"So the big lover argues with his father. Little shiksas with skirts up round their tuchus. You know all about. Dancing the watsui and the cha-cha, yeah. But diamonds you know from nothing."
This declaration precipitated a full-scale family argument, in which each of the brothers joined with gusto.
Shut up, back to work, all of you. Out, out, out.
Aaron broke up the meeting, driving his sons from the office and slamming the door behind them.
Shoo! He looked to heaven. What a business! Now we can weigh the stones.
When they had weighed and tallied the stones, and Aaron had locked them into the safe, Benedict told him, "I'm thinking of breaking up the ring." Aaron froze and looked across the desk at Benedict. Between them there was always the pretense that their relationship was legitimate. They never spoke about the ring, or where the unregistered stones came from, or how the finished gems were sent to Switzerland.
"Why?"
Aaron asked carefully.
"I'm a rich man now, with my father's money and what I've made from the ring and invested. A very rich man. I no longer need to take the risks." "Such problems I wish I had. But perhaps you are wise. I would not think to argue with you."
"There will be 1 or 2 more packages, then it will be finished." Aaron nodded.
"I understand," he said. "Like all good things, it must end."
It was a little after noon when Benedict parked the Bentley outside the Mews flat off Belgrave Square. He went to shower immediately he was home. In all the years he had lived here, he had never grown accustomed to London's grime-laden atmosphere, and he bathed or showered at least 3 times a day. He sang in the shower, and then, enveloped in a huge bath towel, he left a string of damp footprints through to the lounge, where he mixed a martini and screwed up his eyes at the first stinging taste of the drink. The phone rang. "Thunder Bale," he said into the mouthpiece, and then his expression changed as he listened. Quickly he put down the glass and used both hands to hold the telephone receiver. "What on earth are you doing here?" His tone of astonishment was not faked. "What a wonderful surprise! When can I see you? How about right now? For lunch? Oh, that's great. No, nothing I can't put off. This is a pretty special occasion, you know. Where are you staying?" "The Lancaster." "Fine. Now, look, give me 45 minutes and I'll meet you in the looking-glass room on the top floor. 1:10. God, what a delightful... I've said that already, yes. See you in 3/4 hour. He replaced the receiver, swallowed the remains of his martini, and headed for his bedroom suite. This would make a good day into a truly remarkable one, he thought, as he quickly selected a silk shirt. He looked at his reflection in the mirror and grinned. "The ball has already started bouncing your way, Benedict," he whispered. She was not at the bar, nor in the looking-glass room. Benedict crossed to the tall picture windows for a glimpse of one of London's finest views across Hyde Park and the Serpentine. It was a smoky blue day, and the pale sun added bronze to the autumn shades of gold and red in the park. He turned from the windows, and she was crossing the room towards him. His stomach swooped with delight, for she was also pale gold with the coppery sheen of sun on her long legs and bare arms. The grace of her carriage was as he remembered it, the precise lifting and laying down of narrow feet on the thick pile of the carpet. He stood quite still, letting her come to him. Heads turned all across the room, for she was a splendid golden creature. Benedict knew suddenly and clearly that he wanted this woman for himself. "Hello, Benedict," she said, and he stepped forward to take her hand in both of his. "Ruby Lance." He squeezed her long fingers gently. "It's so good to see you again." The use of her surname was the clue to the strength of his reaction. She belonged to the one man in the world that Benedict most envied and hated. For this reason she was infinitely desirable. "Let us celebrate with a little drink. I think the occasion deserves, at the very least, a champagne cocktail." She sat with those long, slim legs neatly crossed, leaning back in her chair, holding the stemmed glass with tapering fingers. Her hair hung straight to her shoulders, like some rare silken tapestry in white gold, and her eyes watched him with a cat-like candour, a calm feline intentness that seemed to look into his soul. "I shouldn't have bothered you," she said, "but I know so few people here." "How long can you stay?" He brushed aside the disclaimer. "I must cancel my other arrangements." "A week," she made it sound like an offer that was subject to negotiation. "Oh, no," his voice was mock distressed. "You can do better than that. We won't be able to do half what I had planned in so short a time. Oh, you can stay longer, surely." "Perhaps," she agreed, and lifted the glass an inch. "It's good to see you." "And you," Benedict agreed with emphasis. They sipped the sparkling wine, watching each other's eyes. Where others must wait weeks and months, Benedict went in immediately as though it were his right. A smile and a murmured word, and theatre tickets were his, or the doors of fashionable restaurants opened magically. That first night he took her to the National Theatre, then for dinner at Le Coeur de France, where a very famous movie actor stopped at their table. "Hello, Benedict. We're all going on to the yacht later for a bit of a party. Join us, won't you?" And those legendary eyes turned on Ruby. "And bring your beautiful friend with you." They ate breakfast under the awning, on the after-deck of the yacht, eggs and bacon and Veuve Clicquot champagne, and watched the hubbub of dawn traffic on the wondrously smelly old Thames. Ruby was the only girl in the party without a fur to cheat the chill of the river dawn. Benedict made a mental note of the fact. On the way home, she sat with those long legs curled under her seat. still sleek and golden despite the night's exertions, but with the lightest touch of blue beneath her eyes. "I can't remember having enjoyed an evening so much, Benedict." She patted a tiny pink-lipped yawn. "You're a wonderful companion." "Tonight again?" he asked. "Yes, please," she murmured. She sensed an urgency in him when she came down into the lobby of the Lancaster that evening. He came quickly to meet her as she stepped out of the lift, and the quiet assurance with which he kissed her cheek and took her arm surprised her. They were silent as he snaked the Bentley through the evening traffic. Ruby realized that at the tips of her long tapered fingers, within touching distance, was a fortune such as she had never before allowed herself to dream about. She was deadly afraid. A wrong move, even a word wrong, might drive that fortune beyond her grasp forever. She would never have a chance like this again, and she was afraid to move, almost paralyzed with fear. The decision she knew she would have to make very soon would be fateful. Must she encounter his advance with withdrawal, or must she meet it as frankly as it was made? She was so deeply involved with her thoughts that when the Bentley came to a standstill, she looked up with surprise. They were parked in a mews outside an expensive-looking flat. Benedict came round and opened her door and led her without protest into the flat. She looked about her curiously, recognizing some of the artworks on display in the entrance hall. Benedict took her through into the long lounge and settled her solicitously into the tapestry-covered chair which dominated the room like a throne. And suddenly her fear was gone. She felt queen-like in her control. She knew with certainty that this would all be hers. Benedict stood in the centre of the room, almost a petitioner in his attitude, and he began to speak. She listened quietly, her expression showing no hint of the triumphant surge of her spirits, and when he stopped to wait for her reply, she did not hesitate. "Yes," she said. "I'll be with you when you tell him," Benedict promised. "It won't be necessary," Ruby assured him. "I can handle Johnny Lance." "No." Swiftly, Benedict crossed to her chair and took her hands, drawing her to her feet. "I must be there with you. Promise me that." Then it became suddenly evident to Ruby that the strength of her position was unassailable. Benedict needed her not for any physical reasons, but merely because she belonged to Johnny Lance. Looking steadily into Benedict's eyes, she determined to test her intuition. "He does not have to know about you," she said. "I could arrange a divorce with him." "He must know about me. That's what I want, don't you see?"
"Yes, I see."
She was secure.
"It is agreed?"
He could barely conceal his anxiety.
"Yes,"
she nodded. "It's agreed." And they smiled at each other, each completely satisfied.
"Come."
He led her almost reverently into his bedroom. And Ruby stopped in the doorway with a little cry of delight. The double bed was a mountain of glowing fur in a score of shades, ranging from soft pinkish cream through beige and oyster, pale smoky blue, to midnight and jet glossy black.
"Choose one," he ordered her, "to seal our bargain."
She moved like a sleepwalker towards the bed. But as she reached the centre of the khedive carpet, Benedict called out softly,
"Wait."
She stopped obediently, and he came up behind her. She felt his hands on the back of her neck, and she lowered her chin, shaking her hair forward so that he could unlock the clasp and draw down the fastening of her dress. She stepped out of the dress as it dropped around her ankles, then waited passively as he carefully removed her bra.
"Now," he said, "now try them on."
In her stockings and high-heeled shoes, she went to the bed, subtly emphasizing the lilt of her movements, and took up the first fur. Benedict was sprawled in the wing-back chair across the room as she glanced back at him. His face was gloating and flushed, so that his features seemed swollen and coarsened as he stared at her. She understood now that this was a form of ritual in which they were engaged. Like a victorious Roman general, Benedict was conducting his own personal triumph, reviewing the spoils and the plunder. It had no basis in sexual or physical desire, but was rather a service of worship to Benedict himself. She was the priestess of this rite. Yet knowing this, Ruby felt no resentment. Rather, she found herself excited by the cold perversity of the pageant, as she paraded and postured, turned and swirled and flared the skirts of a wild mink. She was very conscious of his eyes upon her body. She knew it was perfect, and his scrutiny stirred her physically for the first time in her life. She felt her blood quicken and pound, felt her heart flutter within its cage of ribs, like a captive bird, and her loins tighten like a clenching fist. For her also the ritual was narcissistic, satisfying her own deep emotional need. As she discarded each of the coats, she dropped it in the centre of the floor until there was a knee-high pile of precious fur. At last she faced him, hugging the soft creamy cloud tightly about her body. Then she opened her arms, and the coat also, standing on tiptoe to tighten and highlight the hard muscle in her legs and flanks. "This one," she whispered, and he came out of the chair, picked her up in his arms, and laid her, still wrapped in mink, on the great pile of mink. Ruby woke in the double bed to a feeling of excitement and enormous well-being, such as she had not experienced since she was a schoolgirl on the first morning of a holiday. The morning was far advanced. Pale sunshine in a square shaft poured through the open window like a stage effect. Benedict, in a yellow silk dressing gown, stood beside the bed watching her with an unfathomable expression which changed immediately he realized that she was awake. "My man has collected your luggage from the Lancaster. Your toilet things are in the bathroom, your clothing is in the dressing room." He sat down carefully on the edge of the bed, and leaned forward to kiss her forehead, and then each cheek. "We'll breakfast when you are ready." He sat back and watched her eyes. Clearly he was waiting for her to say something important. Immediately she was on guard, wary of making a mistake, seeking a clue in his expression. "Last night," he asked, "was it good for you? Was it as good for you as it was for me?" Understanding washed over her in a warm wave. He wanted assurance, a comparison between himself and Johnny Lance. "I have never in my life," she placed the emphasis carefully, "experienced anything like it." He nodded, relieved, pleased, and stood up. "After breakfast we'll go to town." This morning Edmund, Benedict's man, chauffeured the Bentley, when they alighted at the north end of Bond Street and walked arm in arm along the pavement, Edmund tailed them at a dignified crawl, steadfastly ignoring the abuse of other drivers. The morning was cool enough for Ruby to wear her new cream mink, and the looks of admiration and envy she drew from the other strollers delighted Benedict. He wanted to impress her. He wanted to flaunt his wealth. "The wife of a diamond man must have diamonds," he spoke on impulse, as they came up to an expensive-looking jeweller's. Ruby squeezed his arm and turned to look into the window. "Good Lord!" Benedict laughed. "Not here!" And Ruby looked at him with surprise. Mockingly, Benedict began reading the signs in the window. "Paradise Jewellers, a large selection of blue-white gems, certificate of flawlessness with every diamond, perfect flawless stones at bargain prices as advertised on TV and in the national press. Small deposit secures your ring now. A diamond is forever. Show her you really care. Come on." "But they're such a well-known firm. They have branches all over the world, even in South Africa," Ruby protested, and bridled a little as Benedict smiled patronizingly. "Let me explain about diamonds. They are bought for two reasons by two different types of people. Firstly, by rich men as investments that will not erode and can only increase in value. These men buy notable stones on the advice of experts. The best of the gem diamond production goes to them. So when Richard Burton buys Liz a £300,000 diamond, he is not being extravagant. On the contrary, he's being ultra-conservative and thrifty with his money." "That's the kind of meanness I like," Ruby laughed, and Benedict smiled at her honesty. "You may find me as thrifty," he promised. "Go on," she said. "Tell me more about diamonds." "Well, there's another type who buys diamonds, usually just one in his life, luckily for him, and he very seldom tries to resell it again, or he'd get a nasty shock. This type is Joe Everybody, who wants to get married. He usually goes to somebody like Paradise Jewelers. Benedict poked a derisive finger at the sign in the window. Because he's seen it on telly, and he can get a ring on the instalment plan. In many cases, the deposit covers the dealer for the cost of the stone. The rest goes on advertising, finance charges, and, of course, profit. How do you know Paradise Jewelers are that type? Ruby's attention was wide-eyed and girlish. You recognise them firstly by the big advertising splurge, then by their language. Again, he studied the notices in the window. A large selection of blue-white gems. Of every 1,000 stones of jewellery, quality produced, only one is fine enough in colour to be termed blue-white. It is unlikely they have a large selection. Gem is a special term reserved for a diamond which is in every way superb. Flawless stones at bargain prices. The lack of flaws in a diamond is only one of many factors governing its value. As for bargain prices, there ain't no such animal. Prices are maintained at the lowest level by fierce competition among experts and canny dealers, and there are no sales or special prices for anyone.
But where should a person buy a diamond? Ruby was impressed and dismayed, despite herself.
Not here, Benedict chuckled. Come, I'll show you. And before she could protest, he had taken her arm and swept her into the shop to be greeted with enthusiasm by the manager, who must have noticed Ruby's mink and the attendant Bentley, which was causing a small traffic jam outside the shop.
Good morning, madam and sir. May I be of service to you?
Yes, Benedict turned to Ruby, as they settled down in the manager's office, with a tray of diamond rings in front of them. You cannot examine a diamond properly in its setting. He selected the biggest diamond, took from his pocket a gold-plated penknife fitted with a special tool, and prized open the claws of the setting to a chorus of horrified squeals from the staff. I'll make good any damage, he snapped, and they subsided as Benedict took the loose stone and laid it on the velvet-covered tray. Firstly, size. The stone is about 1 carat. He looked for confirmation to the manager, who nodded. Let us say the value of the stone is £500. 10 similar stones will be worth £5,000, right? However, a 10-carat stone may be worth as much as £75,000, so the price per carat rises sharply as the total weight of the stone increases. If I were investing, I wouldn't touch a stone under 3 carats. The staff were listening now with as much attention as Ruby. Next, colour, said Benedict, and glanced at the manager. A sheet of clean white paper, please. The manager scratched in his drawer and laid a sheet of paper in front of Benedict, who placed the stone upon it, bottom upwards. We compare the colour it draws from white paper in good natural light. He looked up at the manager. Switch off the fluorescent lights and open those curtains, please. The manager obeyed with alacrity. This is a matter of experience. The colour is judged by a standard. We forget about the fancy rare colours like blue and red and green and take our top standard as blue-white. A stone so white as to appear slightly blue, after which the distinctions drop to fine white and white. Then stones which draw a yellowish tinge, which we call cape, in different shades. Then finally stones which draw a brown colour, which will reduce the value of a stone by up to 80%. Benedict fished in his fob pocket and pulled out a guinea case, which he opened. Every expert carries a special diamond, which he uses as a gauge for colour, by which to judge all other stones. This is mine. The staff exchanged apprehensive looks as Benedict placed a small diamond beside the other. He studied them a moment, then replaced his gauge in the case. Second silver cape, I'd say, he grunted, and the staff looked suitably abashed. Now we consider the stone's perfection. He looked at the manager. Please lend me your looper. Looper? The manager was mystified. Yes, your jeweller's glass. The manager was deeply embarrassed. You sell diamonds, yet you do not own a loop? Benedict shook his head in disapproval. No matter, I have my own. Benedict took the glass from his inner pocket and placed it in his eye. Imperfections can be almost negligible. A natural at the girdle or a bubble or pinpoint of carbon in the stone, on the other hand, they can be gross cracks.
clouds, ice, or feathers, which will ruin the value of the stone. But this one is flawless, so when the certificate of flawlessness is issued, there will be no misrepresentation. Benedict closed the glass and tucked it back into his pocket. However, in order to produce a flawless stone, the cut has been squeezed. He held up the stone between thumb and forefinger. The cut or make of a stone is the fourth and final decider of its value. The make should conform closely to the ideal. This stone has been cut to exclude a flaw, and in consequence it is badly proportioned, heavy and out of round. I would prefer to see a graceful stone which includes a slight imperfection, rather than a grotesque little cripple like this. He put the diamond down on the desk. The asking price by Paradise Jewellers for this stone is £500, which would be fair and correct for a gem. However, the colour is poor, although it is flawless. It is of ungainly make. Its true value would be about, let's see, £185 approximately. There was another chorus of protest from the assembled staff, led by the manager. I assure you, sir, that all our stones have been most carefully appraised. How long have you been with Paradise Jewellers? Benedict demanded brusquely. 4 months, isn't it? The manager gaped at him. Before that, you were a salesman in a showroom of a large firm of embalmers and undertakers. The manager fluttered his hands weakly. But how did you know that? I like to know about all my employees. Employees? The manager looked stunned. That's correct. My name is Benedict van der Bael. I own Paradise Jewellers. Ruby clapped her hands and cooed her applause. What a bundle of surprises you are, she exclaimed. Benedict smiled in acknowledgement and inclined his head. Now, he said, as he rose and helped Ruby to her feet, we'll go and buy some real diamonds. Aaron Cohen sold them 2 fine white twin Marquise cut brilliants, and Ruby chose the mounting for a pair of white gold earrings from a leather-bound catalogue. Benedict gave Aaron his cheque for £20,000, then turned to Ruby. Now, he said, we'll have lunch at the Celeste Grill Room. The food is bloody awful, but the decor is stupendous. We had best phone and reserve a table. It isn't really necessary, but they get terribly hurt if you don't. As they settled back in the lush upholstery of the Bentley, Benedict instructed the chauffeur, go past Trafalgar Square, Edmund. I want to pick up the newspapers from South Africa House. Edmund double-parked outside the ambassador's entrance, and the doorman recognised the car and hurried inside to fetch the bundle of newspapers. As they pulled away around the square towards Haymarket, Benedict selected a copy of the Cape Argus. Let's see what's happened at home, he glanced at the front page and stiffened perceptibly. What is it? Ruby leaned towards him anxiously, but he ignored her. His eyes were darting across the page like the shuttle of a loom. She saw the colour fade from his face, leaving it white and intent. He finished reading and pushed the paper towards her. She spread the page. Van der Bael Diamonds win valuable concession. Appeal Court supports Kaiser's mineral grant. Lance gets thunderbolt and suicide. Bloemfontein, Thursday. In an urgent application by the Central Diamond Mines Limited to prevent Van der Bael Diamonds Limited prospecting and mining a concession area off the southwest African coast, Mr. Justice Tromp today dismissed the application with costs, stating in his judgment, the original concession granted by German Imperial Decree in 1899 and subsequently ratified by Act of the Union Parliament in Act 24 of the 1920 must hold good in law and will take precedent over any subsequent grant or concession purporting to have been made by the Minister of Mines to any other party. The area in dispute covers 100 square kilometres surrounding 2 small islands lying some 15 miles south of Cartridge Bay and 5 miles offshore. The islands are known as Thunderbolt Island and Suicide Island, and at the turn of the century were the site of considerable exploitation by a German guano company. Mr. John Rigby Lance, the general manager of Van der Bael Diamond Company Limited, acquired the rights to the concession when he took over the inoperative guano company. In Cape Town today, Mr. Lance stated, it's the opportunity I have waited for all my life. All indications are that Thunderbolt and Suicide will prove to be one of the richest marine diamond fields in the world. Van der Bael Diamond Company had a diamond dredging vessel nearing completion in the United Kingdom
and Mr. Lance stated that he hoped to begin recovery operations off Thunderbolt and Suicide Islands before the end of the year. Ruby lowered the paper and looked at Benedict. What she saw was an intense physical shock. Benedict had crumpled down in the seat. Gone was all the assurance and savoir-faire. His face was deathly pale, but now his lips trembled, and with disgust she saw that his eyes were swimming with tears. He hunched forward over his hands, shaking his head gently and hopelessly. "The bastard," he whispered, and his voice was soggy and muffled. "He does it every time. I thought that I had him at last, but, oh, God, I hate him." He looked at her, his face soft with self-pity. "He does it every time. Often I've thought I had him, but he just..." She was mystified by his reaction. "But aren't you pleased? Thunderbale diamonds will make millions." "No, no," he cut in savagely. And then the years of hatred and frustration and humiliation began pouring out. Ruby listened quietly, slowly beginning to understand it all, marvelling at the accumulation of pain and hatred that he exposed for her. He remembered conversations from 20 years ago, small childhood episodes, innocent remarks that had festered and rankled for a decade. "You don't want him to succeed, is that it?" she asked. "I want to crush him, break him, humiliate him." For 10 seconds, Ruby was silent. "Well, what are you going to do about it?" she asked flatly. "Nothing, I suppose." Benedict's tone irritated her. "He always comes out on top. You just can't..." "Nonsense," Ruby snapped. She was angry now. "Let's go over it carefully and see how we can stop him. He's only human, and you've shown me enough to prove you are a brilliant and successful businessman." Benedict's expression changed, becoming trusting and animated. He turned to her almost eagerly. He blinked his eyes. "Do you really believe that?" The bunk was too narrow, Sergio Caporetti decided. Much too narrow. He would have one of the carpenters alter it today. He lay on his back, wedged in firmly, with the blanket-covered mound of his belly blocking his view southwards. He lay and assessed his physical condition. It was surprisingly good. There were but a small, blurred pain behind his eyes, and the taste of stale cigars and rank wine in the back of his throat was bearable. The leaden feeling in his lower limbs alarmed him until he realized that he was still wearing his heavy fisherman's boots. He remembered one of the girls complaining about that. He hoisted himself on one elbow and looked at the girls, one on each side of him, jamming him solidly into the bunk with magnificent hillocks of pink flesh. Big, strong girls, both of them. He had chosen them with care, neither of them an ounce under 12 stone. Sergio sighed happily. It had been a wonderful weekend. The girls were snoring in such harmony that it might have been a rehearsed stage act. He listened to them with mild admiration for a few minutes, then crawled over the outside girl and stood in the centre of the cabin, clad only in his heavy boots. He yawned extravagantly, scratching the thick black wiry curls that covered his chest and belly, and cocked an eye at the bulkhead clock. 4 o'clock on a Monday morning, but had been a truly memorable weekend. The table was hidden under a forest of empty wine bottles and dirty plates. There was a congealed mass of cold spaghetti bolognese in a dish, and he picked it up. As he clumped out of the cabin onto the Kingfisher's bridge, he was scooping up spaghetti with his fingers and cramming it into his mouth. He stood at the rail of the bridge, a naked, hairy figure in tall black boots, clutching a dish of spaghetti to his chest, and looked around the dockyard.